Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Monday. It's December 23rd. It's party time or holiday time. We've already begun with Hanukkah, and then it's Christmas, and there's Kwanzaa, and there's New Year's, and my God, it's everything, and maybe some goodwill toward men. That would be nice, and women, too, let's not forget. And So we're going to talk to a good man, and we wish him all the goodwill, of course, and that's none other than John Bailey, who is the Monday Westchester on the Level co-host. Good morning, Mr. Bailey. How are you?
Good. Good morning from White Plains, New York, USA, and greetings of the season to you, Mr. Harris.
Thank you. Well, you know, I guess one of the most compelling things that I read recently was a lot of things, but I mostly read it on your website, which is always a thrill, and that is the White Plains Citizenet Reporter, to which you are the publisher and the editor. WPCNR.com is a short way to get to it, and always compelling. And I guess one of the most interesting things is that you have been always introspective about the Mario M. Cuomo Bridge and the toll hikes that at one time were never expected, and we never really got a price factor, did we?
No, we never did.
No, and you were ahead of the game on that one. Well, so many issues, but I don't know if you get celebrated enough for all this stuff, but I think you should be. You applauded at the minimum. So what did happen? What is going on? How come all of a sudden there are going to be cost changes and things that they never thought about? Like,
well, the problem is they now have to start paying the debt.
Cashless.
They have to start paying the debt down.
They didn't know that, John. They didn't know that before, right?
Well, they also have to protect the governorship from too much criticism. So that's why the tolls are not going up for Westchester, Rockland folks until 2022, yeah. 2021 and 2022. And it's only going to go up about a dollar or so. But why is that? Well, I'll tell you why. Because if they raise it much more than that, they're going to have a real backlash against whoever runs for governor.
Oh my God, I had no idea. John, you're as pithy as they come. How fantastic. But
why would you
a couple of years ago?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that this is just done because whoever runs for governor on the Democratic ticket would usually be a shoo-in, but they would be really assailed if undermined by a reasonably hefty toll hike. But what did they do?
But you know what's
they
interesting?
They socked it to the truckers. Yeah. They socked it to commercial traffic. It's going up an incredible amount of money, and that is not as bad as it seems because it's deductible. It's the cost of doing business.
Absolutely, it is deductible. But it's deductible on the federal level more so than
it is
on the state.
It means it decreases.
Am I right?
It decreases the taxes that they pay. They're getting a tremendous tax hike, unless you're an independent
What's interesting, and you point that out in your article, is they balance this out by not increasing the costs as much as one thinks. But in reality, they're not taking responsibility for the building of the bridge, as they are claiming that in order to move traffic in a much better light and much better methodology, they want a cashless capacity to collect tolls. And that is where they're placing the burden of responsibility for this unforeseen aspect of this bridge. It is not interesting. They had no clue that this was going to be necessary. How come?
Well, That I'm really suspicious, because when you were talking about the cashless toll monitoring, they are not collecting the tolls from the persons that don't have Easy Pass. They just aren't.
Mm-hmm.
At Spartan Dival Bridge, where that is in effect, they don't go after the people. Because they just chalk it up as a loss of doing business, which I feel is absolutely ridiculous.
It is. It's outrageous.
Yes,
why?
It means.
Why have an easy pass?
Why have an easy pass if they're not going to go after it? Now, what they're supposedly going to do on the new Tappan Zee Bridge, I guess, is to. Go after them and only build them once. But they've governor vetoed a penalty for those who don't pay it when they're built.
Yes.
He vetoed a penalty. Come on, that means you don't pay it if you skip
it. Right, exactly.
And not only that, but in the website, on the New York website, my friend Peter Katz, we were looking at it the other night, and there's a whole congestion pricing where the tolls go up for motor vehicles, cars, by the half hour.
Yeah, that was really amazing. I don't know how did they, I don't even know how
now,
this is going to
work,
mean? But evidently it's all automatic.
What does that mean?
Well, you don't even know that they're raising the price on you, because I guess they'll tell us when it's time to travel, but then you could be stuck in traffic and find out you're paying higher bills. And you
they
just
are
never
taking advantage of the lousy traffic on the new Tappan Zee Bridge. And another thing about this, is they have the Journal News, and one of the absolutely all-time heavy effort stories reported that truck traffic has increased by about twice in 5 years. What a problem.
But that's
that
because,
was given to them.
Well, that was, they're now trying to fill that hole. Evidently, truckers are not stupid and they have to travel these routes, and it's really quite expensive to cross the bridges.
So they go
to
the
New
cheaper
York.
Bridge. They go to the
exactly.
cheaper bridge.
And that's where they went. So they went to the George Washington Bridge or some other route. They just changed the traffic pattern, for example, in Brooklyn and Staten Island, so that they can collect going and coming. Because what used to do, by when they had a one-way collection, people would travel in the opposite direction where they didn't collect the money and exit in the direction that they could, where they didn't have to pay either. So they were avoiding these tolls. I mean, what's wrong with the people who do the planning?
Well, they don't plan
well. They get the big bucks, you know.
Yes, they don't plan well. I'm sorry. This is really a ploy for the last 2 years of Governor Cuomo's third term, I think.
Yeah, but I got to ask you, do you really think it's specific to Governor Cuomo? Isn't everybody else doing exactly the same thing? And you got people who are making big bucks, and they keep parroting whoever the boss is, whether good or bad, and they never tell us the truth because they want to hold on to their job where
they
get paid $250,000 a year and maybe a half a million, and they don't give a hoot.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, this business, when we looked at those charts that are on the website, we do not know whether they're in when they expect to put that into effect or whether it's in effect.
No.
Who knows? But I mean, that wasn't explained in the New York Thruway press release, which is
on
the website. No, it wasn't explained.
Not at all.
It's as if no one is talking about what's going to happen in 2023.
Not at all, because I guess that's a different
time. These are proposals. supposedly.
Well, when is the governor race coming online? It's in 2 years, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
So perfect timing, right?
Exactly. Now, if the governor decides to run for president to replace an aging Joe Biden,
yeah,
I mean, it works out for him.
We'll see if Joe Biden is the final victor, but that's another story.
Go ahead.
Well, I just
moving
remind
on.
People because when you say things like it's on my website, in case people didn't know, your website is WPCNR.com. Maybe you're embarrassed
right.
to mention it, but I'm not because I respect it so much. So WPCNR.com. Well, the other thing that was really breathtaking about what you've done this week is you spoke to River Journal publisher Alain Begun. So in your interview with him, you learned his concept for resuscitating the local media landscape and what makes it different that most people are unaware of. How would you describe that?
Well, it's monthly, number one.
Yes.
Number two, it's a guaranteed circulation. In other words, they go to 23,000 people every month. And it's a very big, thick paper, has a lot of stuff and that are town-specific to the seven towns that they do cover. And not only that, but they are expanding it to Peekskill,
mm-hmm.
Portland, and Croton-on-Hudson up in the north part of
right.
the county, which have no newspaper, essentially, except
right.
when there's a murder. Or a plant
that's not
closing.
News. I mean, that's an interesting
yes.
sort of news, but it's a pertinent part of the news. But I don't know
yeah.
about you, but maybe in the north part of the county, like for example in Yonkers, since we've got the acting police commissioner in Yonkers, guy
mm-hmm.
who's now the actual police commissioner, John Mueller. You know
mm-hmm.
what? Since the moment he became an acting police commissioner. No news comes out of the police department at all. Nothing. They don't.
Mm-hmm.
They don't send any press releases at all. The only thing that they send notice of is they ask you to may give notice that somebody who may be suffering from some sort of disease or dementia is lost. They left their home or they left the hospital and nobody knows where they are and they're worried about them, and that they want a swarm. But otherwise, to tell us there might have been a purse snatching, no. God forbid, a murder in Getty Square, no. None of that stuff ever comes out. So whose fault is it that we don't have good reporting when government doesn't speak to us? Isn't that their job, to be open?
Well,
evidently
I always
not.
Thought the job of a police department was to warn persons about crime trends, ask for
yes.
citizenry help if you notice something or suspicious activity in
right.
this neighborhood, please advise us, give us a number to call. If you have the White Plains Police Department used to do that. They don't do that as much
anymore.
They don't
do that anymore?
Not
well,
as much.
You know, that's what's so interesting. Somebody sent me a copy of today's version of City and State. And they were talking about what you and I have been talking about weeks and weeks ago, about the collapse of media in our part of the world, where the media has not been doing a bang-up job. And then a lot of our print papers are failing, you know, more like the Journal News. They just went through a merger, but they're gutting people out. They fired people last month, and they expected to fire more people come February. But you know what? I still believe, and I still think the same thing has been going on even in the New York Times, that even though they made believe they were reporting news, it was fluff. It was so watered down. It was the most timid reporting you could ever imagine. And at the end of the day, we never learned very much. It just scratched the surface. and you don't get good reporting. They may believe it was great reporting, but it wasn't.
They're the New York Times,
even Walter
after
all. Cronkite.
Yes.
Yeah, remember even Walter Cronkite when he reported the news? Really? Did anyone ever report that Salinger was hiding the fact that the president was banging away with Marilyn Monroe? No. Everything was covered up. Why was
yes,
that permitted?
I mean, because the news media considered themselves part of the establishment. They were Cronkite.
That's how they figured it.
Cronkite was he reported on the Vietnam War for years, and then he finally said, he came out on the air saying, we can't win it. I forget what he did say. And this was such amazing that he did that he was extolled as a hero in journalism. However, the reporting of the Vietnam War, as I recall it, I mean, it was extremely visual, and it just made it. And they also ran the death toll each night. Remember that? Every American soldier killed, that was a bit of editorializing, I thought. It was recognizing the dead, of course, but it socked in the real toll of the war. But by doing that, you're making a conscious decision.
Well, you know what's so interesting is that when it comes to, for example, we've just found out, this only came out now, and that was, it was a ploy that they used for many, many, many years. And that is like, when it came to Afghanistan, they never told us that there was no plan, but they spent $18 trillion. And we're still there. Doing what?
Still there.
I have no idea. And we're going to get pushed out of the door. And then, and we spent $18 trillion, and they're going to talk it up like they've succeeded.
And they are.
But how many
governments have the nerve to discuss peace with the Taliban?
Yeah, and how many governments have been there that were part of this whole process? 18 years.
Russia.
So we go back, President Trump, President Obama. I don't even remember anymore who was before, but 18 years back. So what the hell goes on in this country? And then they talk about reporting.
It's a money maker.
How come it's never been reported? Yeah, it is.
It's a moneymaker. They fight that war because they like keeping the defense budget up.
Well, I can understand wanting to keep the defense
budget up. And they don't fight it. And they don't fight it with the intention to win. This is another Vietnam we've gotten ourselves into.
Exactly.
Because if they really wanted to really bring them to heel, the poppy fields would be destroyed. They would destroy the poppy fields. The drug trade worldwide would be severely hurt.
Absolutely.
They never done that.
But we don't do that
either. The excuse was, we don't want to hurt the peasants. The peasants, are killing thousands of people.
Yeah, well, while all the cocaine growers in Peru and in Brazil across the border, they are doing their thing, and they're growing coca leaves and putting it in kerosene or whatever, however they concoct this stuff. The bottom line is, we permit that. We don't do anything about that, and then we permit it to come into the country somehow. But you know what?
Yeah,
$18 trillion.
Somehow we let everything illegal into this country. Sex trafficking, for example.
Yeah. Well, before you go there, if we spend $18 trillion on our infrastructure as well as in development, then we would be in a much better place, and then we would be able to maintain our military instead of having those idiots over at Boeing who still can't get that goddamn max jet to fly,
This Boeing situation is an unbelievable scandal because basically doomed people because they didn't fix the software right. They just didn't. That is negligence. That aircraft should be tossed, but everybody's afraid to do that because it'll really hurt Boeing. They don't care about lives. FAA really cut them super slack on that one.
Well, but the thing is, it doesn't matter if they care about lives or not. I don't know about other airplanes, but the point is they were so greedy, they messed up. We can't get that plane to fly again for over two years already?
And they're still flying.
And then the thing that really matters here is that the U.S. economy is going to be beaten to death by our competition, whether it comes from Europe, whether it comes from China, or whether it comes from Russia, or even though they say, well, nobody wants to fly a Russian plane. Well, their planes didn't go down. Ours did. How come? Oh, it's
because
a joke already.
Because
when are we going to get
Boeing people, right, the Boeing people knew that there was something wrong, and they glommed over it.
Yeah.
They glommed
exactly.
it. And that is
I'm
really
disgusted.
I mean, how many people were killed in those two crashes, or was it three?
I think it was two that I understand, and I think it was about 400 between the two of them. One in Ethiopia, and another one I don't remember now where. The second one also. The first one was in Ethiopia. Where was the other one? I don't remember. Must be getting old, John. I'm sorry.
But Boeing just tried to put a pretty face on 300 to 400 deaths.
Yep. Well, it's worse because they really may have ruined Boeing and the whole business, and it'll take a long time for people to consider buying from them again. And that's a really big problem. They hurt the U.S. economy. But you know what? I still say every one of those bozos who work there, if they're a lower echelon, fine, they're just workers. But you know what? Management should be all put in jail. And God help us if we have to bail them out. That's another problem. We're going to bail them out, and what are we going to be left with? The same idiots that were there before. We're going to run.
I guarantee they'll be bailed out. Bad management at the top, that if you're a national force company, are always bailed out because they can't afford to have you fail.
Yeah.
And Detroit, good example of that.
Yeah, Detroit.
And they've done that a few times. Yes. Remember Lee Iacocca? Yes. And
I certainly do.
That was the beginning. Yes, right.
Yeah.
And so now my big pet peeve is this pharma, the Sackler company.
Oh yeah, big pharma.
That has really knowledgeably caused the death of thousands of people. And those guys
Absolutely.
Have not been charged with negligent manslaughter, at least.
No, they haven't. No, they haven't.
They should be.
I mean, we happen to do that to a lot
of Nazis for doing something similar.
Yeah. I spoke to a guy last week who owned, I think it was six different pharmacies across Westchester County, five in Yonkers, one somewhere else. But the bottom line is he says they're operatives called PBMs. They're people in the middle between the pharmacy and the medical profession. So if a doctor issues you a prescription, these people, the PBMs, they are in the middle, and they don't necessarily approve the drug. So even though your doctor gave you this prescription, they can tell the pharmacy, excuse me, but this particular drug that the doctor recommended is not part of your insurance, or they'll make believe that it isn't, and they'll suggest another one where they're making more money in the process.
So in other words, mm-hmm. if there's a choice between one or the other, they make the choice where they make the money. And it's wholly unregulated. I mean, it's
yes.
absolute insanity, the stuff that goes on behind our eyes. And mm-hmm. you know what? I really have to hand it to you, John. I think you certainly started before I did, but you showed me the way in many, many ways.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
Inquisitive. You were very, very inquisitive. You always looked for the truth, and you found it. It wasn't always pretty, but it was what it was.
The truth is not pretty. The truth is not pretty. It's like, once again, the administration has prevailed upon an investigator who supposedly is supposed to be keeping mum, questioning the authorization of the FBI wiretaps in the investigation. Now, isn't that convenient? That is convenient.
It is convenient.
It's like Cuomo.
That's a FISA
it's like
court.
What Cuomo did. Yeah. This guy.
That's the FISA court you're talking about?
Drummond, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
The article in the Times today about it,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the usual questioning Drummond's motives. But look, anytime you get an investigator tipping their hand before they get their investigation in, that is politically motivated.
That's true. Very true.
That's what Cuomo did. And Obama's greatest sin as a president was not revealing the Russian interference before the election.
That's very true as well.
And nobody gives him any
really have to
flack for that, but that's bad civic.
No.
He really betrayed the country by not doing that.
Well, how is it that so many people are unaware? Is it because they don't read? Is it because we're now bamboozled by even the new media? Everything is through Google mm-hmm. search or through some other search engine, and they don't necessarily give us all the information. There's so many naysayers that malign
right.
the truth or the facts that you can't tell the difference. It all sounds good. The language is well written, but it's
exactly.
all spiel. It's shtick.
And exactly.
You know,
now, remember 2 weeks ago, George Latimer had a big press conference appointing Mike Kaplowitz, director of a study
of
county sewage. Well, that is nothing.
Yep.
He introduced this as something new that was his initiative. However, this is the county's reaction to a lawsuit that was filed 5 years ago by Save the Sound. And they won the suit, and they have settled with the county. And one of their suggestions to the county was to examine their sewer system. It's funny, you didn't mention
I know
that.
Our system, no, they didn't. Our sewer system in Yonkers stinks. Actually, you know, it does
literally.
Stink, and it's overextended. It's being overused, and we have a lot of effluent that plunges right into the Hudson River that we spend billions mm-hmm. of dollars to clean up.
Yes.
Constantly doing that all the time. Runoff
however,
is unbelievable.
However, the significance of Latimer announcing this study and appointing a person, Mr. Kaplowitz, mm-hmm. who does not have exactly – you know, he's no Ed Norton, you know?
Wanting credentials.
And yes, right. But the thing is that Save the Sound said that presently they are about ready to settle with White Plains and some of the other towns that are still outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
They've settled with four.
Yeah.
And the towns are going to fix... and they will monitor how towns fix them. Well, what does fix mean? It means money. Now, there are $5 billion. There's $5 billion available from the state for this type of sewer fix.
Mm.
It's basically free money for the towns to fix their sewers. It was made possible by the Clean Air Act. Now, the question is, will this be enough? There are seven towns.
Probably not.
There's the city. There's the county trying to figure out how to make them more efficient. And so we're looking at will $5 billion be enough?
Yeah, it's a great question.
For the state, that's for the state. There's got to be many other communities with aged sewer networks, and but I mean, this is something that has to be watched.
Absolutely. Listen, unfortunately, we've got to go, John. Always compelling. Starting off Monday is a pleasure because we start off with you. So have a great week.
Thanks.
Have a merry, merry Christmas. All the best to you and your family, your associates,
and
your friends.
Well, the Christmas
magic
is kicking in. The Christmas magic is kicking in. We can look forward to Donald Trump's pardons.
Oh, yeah, that's true, too.
That's something
best,
to really
John.
Look forward
Thank
to.
You.
Right.
Goodbye. All right, let's bring in Michael Edelman. Good morning, Michael Edelman. What a pleasure to have you on this morning on Monday. Merry Christmas and happy Hanukkah. You're a lucky dude.
You
get to celebrate both holidays.
That's correct. I've been celebrating.
I don't know how you figured
Christmas
that out,
and
but
Hanukkah when I was 5.
Really?
We always celebrated.
You had a very,
both,
very.
Here.
That is fantastic. My God. So maybe that is the future. You know, it sounds like it should be. So
yeah, everybody should celebrate everything.
I think that's a really great thing. I think it'll be very, very good. I would hope that people think about that into the future.
Well
listen,
I
got to talk to you about
some. Before you ask
the
question, I want to just relay a little story that happened about probably 20 years ago. I went with the Vigaries to midnight mass in the Bronxville Lutheran Church. And after the mass, the Reverend was greeting everybody at the door on the way out. And I said to him, I said, Reverend, I'll bet you I was the only Jew in church tonight. He said, no, Jesus was here.
Well, that is good to know. So I guess we're always welcome in the church. I always felt comfortable in church, and I'm Jewish too. So what can I tell you? Well, actually it's very comforting to know that Jesus is in church. You know, I think it is, at least for me. Well, I want to ask you about some of the stuff that's going on the with regard to the President of the United States. So I guess the House already ruled to cast 2 terms of impeachment against the president. So that was the case. Are the articles of impeachment, do they truly, are they going to come to anything out of that, or are they simply a divisive outcome? Because of what happened, I don't say that he did anything right, the president. He may have done a lot of things wrong. It seems like he did a lot of things wrong. But will it divide our nation in a manner that may be that may define our political landscape for the next 20 or 20 years, 10 years, 30 years? Are we going to be able to, resuscitate our capacity to function after this?
Well, the nation is not all of a sudden divided because of the articles of impeachment. The nation has been divided since Barack Obama was elected. You go back further than that, since George W. Bush beat Al Gore. That election, where the winner of the popular vote lost the Electoral College after a brutal battle about ballots in Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade County in Florida, which is where I live. That divided the nation. Fox News has been divided in the nation because they're not interested in facts. They're interested in spin. I think it was the obligation, constitutional obligation, of the members of the House of Representatives to vote articles of impeachment based on what this president did and then denied. I think if he had shown contrition, which of course he's not capable of doing because he's a malignant narcissist, but if he had shown contrition and said, I went too far, I made a mistake, apologized to the nation, I don't think they would have impeached him. But he kept saying it was a perfect phone call because that's the way he operates.
He's operated that way
right.
all his life. He's a shakedown artist. Okay? And
yeah, he
and
is.
And so we're not done with this, by the way. All right? These articles of impeachment are just the beginning of what you're going to learn about what Donald Trump has been up to. We found out Friday night that Michael Duffy instructed OMB to hold the funds and said, keep it quiet while you're at it. 91 minutes after Trump spoke to Zelensky, the funds were frozen. That is a direct indication that what his intent was after he spoke to Zelensky. He intended to shake him down. And he did so by ordering Michael Duffy to make that email and to hold those funds. So that's in writing. We're also going to learn going forward that Lev Parnas and Igor Grumman were engaged in a scheme to do natural gas business from Texas to Russia with a big donor of Rick Perry's, holding out the fact that they were connected to Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani. We're going to learn that this was just one big business plan that depended on getting rid of Maria Yovanovitch because she was not going to allow a scheme to weaken the president of Ukraine and to get rid of the president of Naftgas.
Yeah, yeah. So when you talk about Yovanovitch, did she do the right thing by is there a mechanism where someone in the know can go and validate what they know in order to really change the dynamics of what's happening? Or is
yes, there is.
No,
it's the
way.
The whistleblower. That's what the whistleblower statute was meant for.
But is
it was
functioning?
Meant to have somebody who saw. Go ahead.
No, is it functioning? I don't know because there aren't enough issues that come forward where you do have whistleblowers. I know, for example,
well, you're
in
not,
Yonkers,
you're
we
not
got
gonna
a lot.
Hear,
of,
you're not going to hear the
yeah.
average whistleblower complaint. It's internal.
No,
that doesn't necessarily become public. This did.
No. Well, this one did, but isn't it important for all these whistleblowers' information to come out? Because at the end, the public is unaware of it. Then we get this spin cycle from media outlet or another.
Yeah, but it's not about the public knowing. It's about having the whistleblower statute was meant to have honest government officials correct something that is wrong in government without there being any price to pay by the whistleblower in terms of blowback. Or a penalty, or loss of job, or anything like that. This government is not honest, so it is not going to respond in any other way than to threaten the whistleblower, which Donald Trump has done on more than one occasion. The idea that they wanted to out the whistleblower, the complaint spoke for itself, and the complaint was corroborated by live testimony in front of the House Intelligence Committee by more than one person. So
it was
also corroborated by release of the transcript by Trump.
So I guess, is the mechanism working then for a whistleblower to be protected on the inside when you have a credible government, maybe not the way the conduct of this particular president? But then I see that the reporting out there in media is seemingly very deficient, maybe not on the national level, but certainly on the local level, and it's becoming really unruly. Government doesn't always, they're not open. There's no access. There's so much deceit. But yeah, of
you
course
have
it depends
your
on the location.
Yeah. There's no whistleblower statute, for example, in the city of Yonkers, but you managed to get information on your site.
You manage to accumulate information from people that are on the inside that want to make things public. I read that all the time.
Yes.
So that's the function of the press. That's why we have a free press, so they can report. And some of the things will be true, but some of the things won't be. But then you follow up and see whether or not there's any, you know, where's the beef if somebody makes a complaint. At the national level, the IG of each department, there's an inspector general. He wants his job is to get the whistleblower complaint and to see whether or not there's any beef there. And in this particular case, the IG found it was serious. It was a serious cause to believe that in this case, the president had done something he shouldn't have done. Now, does that rise to the level of impeachment? That's up to the House of Representatives.
Very, very interesting. So that's where we are right now. And what was the purpose of Pelosi holding off, the beginning of the process of imposing the articles of impeachment? Is that going to wait till January sometime?
Yeah, and it would have waited anyway because it's Christmas.
Correct.
They're not there.
Yeah.
They're on break.
No, exactly.
All the legislators went home.
Yeah. So it's going to wait till January.
Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham have already indicated they're not interested in hearing any evidence. They want to dismiss the articles of impeachment without taking testimony, without hearing live witnesses, because they don't believe that the president did anything wrong. And so
That was so interesting because over the weekend, I think it was on Friday, you pointed out that if the Senate could vote in private, cast their votes without ever becoming known, there was talk that maybe 35 or 30, I think that was the number that I read, about 35 people who are senators would vote for impeachment.
Yeah.
Can the Senate do that?
Yes. No, can they vote? Yes, but they won't. They could take a vote. I assume they could take a vote in private. There's nothing that I know prohibiting it. But the problem with it is that Mitch McConnell won't allow it. And Senator Jeff Flake was simply making the point that regardless of what the senators are saying publicly, they privately believe this guy's a disaster.
Okay.
Now you would think they would stand up to the Constitution, but they're in fear of being tweeted at by the tweeter in chief.
Yeah.
And being mocked, okay? And they're also afraid of primaries in their states. So this is what probably will happen. There will be some procedural votes, for example, on whether or not there should be live testimony. And you've got a number of – you don't need 67 votes, as you do for impeachment, in order to pass those procedural motions. You need 51. There are 47 Republicans. And you have the following senators who are up for re-election in states that are purple that are going to have to make a decision whether they want a fair trial or whether they want people in their home states to believe that they participated in a sham trial. Cory Gardner, Colorado, Susan Collins, Maine, Tom Tillis, North Carolina. Mitt Romney, who's not up for re-election, but he's criticized president anyway, and Lisa Murkowski, these senators are enough to make Mitch McConnell's life miserable if they vote to permit live testimony of Mick Mulvaney, Michael Duffy, Mike Pompeo, and Rudy Giuliani. Because under oath, these guys are not going to lie.
That's the question. Does America recognize that the number one concern of our elected officials is to get reelected?
Yeah, well,
the number one concern of all our politicians is to first get elected, and the second is to get reelected. And it's a moneymaker, and they're adulated and respected, and
it's almost ridiculous to think that once you get into office, unless you decide to relinquish your responsibility as an elected official and you don't stand for re-election, then you're just tired of the whole process. But otherwise, people stay there forever.
Well, 23 members of the House retired. They're not running again.
Yeah.
So they're not staying forever. And the reason they're not running again is, number one, they're in the minority. And number two, they're tired of defending the indefensible. You can't defend Donald Trump. It's not going to end well for this president. It will not end well for him. Whether it's January, February, March, April, May, June, July, I don't know when it's going to end. But when it ends, it's not going to end well.
But, you know, while it should, based on what we know already, it probably shouldn't end well for the president. And there'll be more things that we'll learn in the process. But what about the country? Are we going to be able to heal again? Are we going to be able to have discourse? Is there going to be respect? Or are we just now, we're going down a really deep hole. And I don't know if we'll be able to come out of it.
Well, I don't think anything is a retreat. We've been down this hole before. Joe McCarthy, Huey Long. You know, this is not the first time the nation has been divided. It was divided after the Nixon impeachment. One of the good signs that came out recently is that the publication Christianity Today, which is a evangelical, conservative, pro-life publication, called for the removal of Donald Trump on moral grounds, not on political grounds or legal grounds, on moral grounds.
Yeah.
He's an immoral leader, according to that publication. And there is an editorial, a senior editorial writer for the National Review, who also wrote an editorial. And he couldn't have done this without permission from Rich Lowry, who's the who's the editor-in-chief. He also called for the removal of Donald Trump. And one by one, little by little, slowly but surely, conservatives are lining up against this president. There's a political action committee that was formed by Steve Schmidt, Rick Wilson, and George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's husband. They're putting ads on television. They do not want an authoritarian monarch. They don't want somebody that trashes the Constitution. Donald Trump isn't conservative any way you slice it. He's certainly not a Republican. None of what he does is a reflection of Republican traditional Republicanism, nor is he a good Christian, according to them. And so they are attempting to remove him. So you got to, you know, be patient.
No, I am. I am being patient. I'm trying to watch it. I just I'm worried about the final outcome. He may get off pretty much scot-free because that's a possible prospect. You know, if he decides to step down and give it to Pence and be exonerated, everybody is off, and some people will be happy, and other people say, throw away the key after you throw him in jail. So we're going to have to find out which way that's going to go.
It depends the extent to which they find criminality that they can prosecute after he leaves office, because although there are statutes and there's an Office of Legal Counsel opinion in place that says a sitting president cannot be charged, which is why the Mueller report didn't charge him, even though they found 10 or 11 instances of obstruction of justice, he can certainly be prosecuted after he leaves office.
Well, I got to go back. I now got to go move into the international arena. Kim Jong-un is threatening to throw up some new ballistic missile or new technology that's going on. Evidently, he's boxed the president into a corner. And can the president survive if we find out that Kim Jong-un is also moving the whole process forward, and he's going to make the president, which therefore means America, look like a fool?
Well, I think America already does look like the fool. But what Kim Jong-un is doing is playing the president. And he's making it clear that the president not only isn't a deal maker, he's a con artist. And the president is not only a con artist, but he's been lying to the American people, because while he's suggesting that, he and Kim are in love, there is no relationship there other than giving away the store to the North Koreans and breaking up the alliance we have with South Korea and Japan. John Bolton just gave a scathing talk, I believe it was. I don't think he wrote an op-ed, but he gave a talk on just how wrong the Trump national security policy is with regard to North Korea, because they've been testing short-range missiles. Trump said that's okay. Huh?
And also Afghanistan, too, Bolton talked about.
And
he said that if we were going to be dealing in a certain way, we would have a different attitude toward these issues, but we don't. So evidently he's saying that the behavior of the president is deficient, because he says one thing, but he doesn't do what he says he's going to do. So that becomes also very troublesome. And then the other thing, too, which also shows something that is really been dishonest by the president, was always talking about this company from China called Huawei. And he's imposed sanctions against the company and anybody that's trading with the company. And he's suggesting that their technology will be able to steal important information from our technology. And then only today I read that the president, is suggesting that our companies like the AT&Ts of the world and Verizon and all those should get together and create a competition to the 5G, which is evidently very important. I don't fully understand its capacity. But evidently it's faster, it's more credible, it's more secure. But so now all of a sudden the president's trying to align all these major companies to make an investment together. And before he told us basically a scam story.
He doesn't, to the next, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Isn't that obvious? He went to a rally in Battle Creek, Michigan, and talked about flushing toilets.
I know it's getting a little bit ridiculous as well.
There's a psychiatrist from, I believe, Yale, who diagnosed this guy. I just read it this morning. Not only is a malignant narcissist, but he's engaged in defense techniques like projection constantly. When he wrote that letter to Nancy Pelosi, it was the letter of a psychopath.
Yeah, I haven't heard that term projection in a long time. In other words, what it means is that what you feel, you project onto somebody else as if that's what you're defining them, but in reality, you're really defining yourself.
Yourself, that's correct.
Unbelievable.
You're doing it subconsciously. You're doing it subconsciously.
Correct.
So that when he accuses Nancy Pelosi of trashing the Constitution, he knows he's trashing the Constitution.
Right.
But he's doing it. That letter was not directed at Nancy Pelosi. The letter was directed to his supporters.
Yes.
His cult following.
And yet the divide, though, in the nation is very strong. When the impeachment articles of impeachment were presented, he raised, I understand, $10 million that particular weekend. I mean, are we just divided because we don't think the same way? Are Democrats thinking one way, Republicans basically thinking another? And how do we get to that divide? I mean, were we always has this been going on for 50 years?
Well, I don't know about 50 years, but one of the reasons that we're divided has to do with the fact that there happens to be a network that was developed by Roger Ailes that was specifically designed to be an arm of the conservative wing of the Republican Party. And the opinion portion of that network, which are the Sean Hannity's and the Laura Ingraham's and Jeanine Pirro's, they're not in the business of factually reporting the news. They're in the business of defending the president and distorting the facts in order to do that. So if you can't agree on the facts to begin with, of course you're going to be divided. But in addition to Fox News, you've got websites. You've got OANN News, which doesn't bother with the facts at all.
InfoWars.
Okay, it simply just defends Donald Trump. You've got Breitbart. You've got Drudge.
Yeah.
You've got the Daily Stormer, which is a white nationalist website. You've got all of these counterfactual media outlets that are making money from peddling garbage. Okay?
Absolutely.
And to prove it to you, if you put on
the
regular news portion of Fox, when Shep Smith was there, he left, Chris Wallace, Brett Baer, and there's a woman on in the afternoon, I forget her name, and you compare what they report with what MSNBC, CNN, ABC, CBS report, it's exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And then you turn on the primetime people. They don't even claim they're journalists. They're opinion hosts. And then you get the counterfactual. So what they're doing is entertaining people by feeding them a false narrative when the news side reports the truth.
Well, you know, I've got to ask you, we should tell people we're speaking with Michael Edelman, Esquire, the political analyst, pundit of, extraordinaire, and also evidently you're clairvoyant because you figured all this out before. But how does one in today's news cycle, how does one really have the opportunity that you devote? Because you devote, it's not that you have the time and the opportunity, but you do devote the time to learn all these things. You read so much and you hear so much and you're able to put it together. Most people, if they're lucky if they read a 300-word paragraph on an issue and it's done.
Yep.
They don't have the time to really think about it all. And they don't read
that
much. And how do we know what's credible and what isn't?
Well, when you allow somebody like Sean Hannity to dictate what you think rather than watching and reading, what actually happened, reading the transcript, reading the testimony, watching.
Yeah.
I realize a lot of people don't have that kind of time, and that was my business for many years, so I had to do it. The matter is that then you tend to parrot what you're told. Now, if you're a Republican on top of that, you want to hear stuff that reinforces what you already believe. You don't want to read stuff that says, you're wrong. Because the last thing people want to do is admit they're wrong. They want to believe that they were right in the first place. And anything that reinforces that notion, that's where they get their information from.
So we're very tribal, aren't we? I mean, on the international scale, if the American soccer team fought against Brand X country, we would be rooting most likely for our American team. And in New York, you either root for the New York Mets or the New York Yankees, and that's where you're going to be. You're never going to change, are you? I don't think people change.
Well,
so
it depends.
Is that the way we all are? That's the human condition. What?
Well, that's part of the problem. That's part of the problem. That's why it's going to take so long. The good thing is, though, the fastest growing political party is no party at all, and the fastest growing religion is no religion at all. So
that
over
too.
Time,
yes,
over time, when old people die who have rigid views that are racist and misogynist and anti-liberal, quote unquote, those people will go away. The kids that are coming along, everything will change. We won't be there to see it, but it will.
It will. But is Europe? Did Europe begin this process in Europe, where they're less religious and a lot of the old standards have gone to
to the wayside. They still have a long way to go before it becomes like a Europe that's united. But have they begun the process? Are they successful in what they're trying to do, or only just a little bit?
Only just a little bit. They've got far. They got far right parties all over the place in Europe. When that goes away, they'll have accomplished something. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is enabling Vladimir Putin.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Well, as usual, you've left me stumped and very excited about what you've shared. And I want to wish you again a Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year. All the best to you and your family and your friends.
Same to you.
And
thanks
for making the time. Thank you,
you so much.
Bye-bye. All the best. Be well. Thank you. Oh, how exciting. It's always breathtaking and so revelatory to speak to Michael Edelman. It's just nonstop. He is so, so aware, so astute, and so cerebral, and yet it's at the same time so understandable, which not everyone can claim. So very, very exciting. Well, let's take a quick break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods, and then we'll be right back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. Well, we have interesting news, of course, to cover, and this is a very, very pertinent. It's about the Nord Stream, meaning the Northern Stream 2. It's expected to be operational in 2020, and a lot of people haven't heard about it, but Berlin expects U.S. sanctions to slightly delay the Russian pipeline. So we'll speak to you about the Russian pipeline and how it's moving and where it's moving from. Actually, it's moving from the Russian city of Ust-Luga, which is not very far away from St. Petersburg, but south of St. Petersburg. And then north of St. Petersburg is another place called Vyborg, and that is also part of the route that will take the gas pipeline from Russia to Germany, and it's going to a place called Greifswald. So anyway, the U.S. sanctions slapped on a controversial Russian gas pipeline to Europe will likely delay the project by several months, but it will still be completed next year. A top German official said that today. The sanctions, quote, will postpone the completion, end quote, of the undersea pipeline, said Peter Bayer, the chancellor for Angela Merkel's transatlantic coordinator. But I expect the pipeline to be finished in the second half of 2020, he told the German public radio Deutschlandfunk. Deutschland is German, Germany, and Funk is radio. So the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was initially slated for completion in early 2020 with a view to being operational in mid-2020. Moscow likewise insisted the U.S. sanctions would not derail the project as it threatened Washington with retaliation. Quote, such sanctions are unacceptable for us, and we are confident that such measures won't prevent finishing the construction of such an important project, the Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters. Quote, in any case, we won't leave such steps unanswered, end quote, he said. As to when and how this will be done, this will depend on Russia's national interest, end quote. Both Moscow and Berlin have reacted furiously to the sanctions imposed by Washington on Friday over the 9.5 billion euro, that's a $10.6 billion pipeline under the Baltic Sea. The American announcements of asset freezes and visa bans targeting companies involved in the project immediately led to Swiss pipeline contractor Allseas halting its work on the remaining stretches. But BIOS said alternative, quote-unquote, solutions could be found to finish the project that would, however, quote, cause delays and be more expensive. He also reiterated Germany's criticism of the United States move, saying, quote, that's not how you treat friends, end quote. Merkel's spokeswoman Ulrika Demmer at the weekend slammed those sanctions as, quote, an interference in our internal affairs, end quote. The United States has long opposed Nord Stream 2, saying the pipeline would give Russia too much influence over security and economic issues in Western Europe. Well, the project aims to double Russia's natural gas deliveries to Germany and is set to transport 55 billion cubic meters of gas to Europe's top economy per year. It would also allow Russia to reroute supplies from overland pipes running through Ukraine, with Kiev expressing concern this would deprive them of vital leverage over its giant neighbor. Some critics, however, have pointed out that Washington's resistance to Nord Stream 2 comes as the U.S. is trying to sell more of its liquefied natural gas to Europe. Switching to more American liquid natural gas, quote, would considerably be more expensive to German consumers, Bayer had said. More than 80% of the Nord Stream 2 project has already been completed, half of it financed by Russia's state-owned Gazprom, that's the gasoline company, and half by five European companies. The European Union has joined the chorus of condemnation of the U.S. penalties, saying the bloc opposed, quote, sanctions against European companies engaged in legal activities, end quote. But the project has divided the European Union, with Poland and some Baltic nations also viewing the pipeline with suspicion over fears Moscow could use it to exert political pressure. In Berlin, Merkel's spokeswoman Demma had said, quote, further discussions are being held with different parties to find a solution. And she says, we will continue to express our view that we don't condone such extraterritorial sanctions, she added. So, a very, very compelling story and something that we need to watch, that is for sure. And this is very interesting because this is coming from the scientific world. Evidently, Johann Rockström, the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, the PIK, is a big picture scientist who strives to see how all the pieces of our planet's complex climate system fit together. In 2009, he co-authored the, quote, planetary boundaries, quote, unquote, concept, which has since become a central paradigm for evaluating Earth's capacity to absorb the impact of human activity. Rockström spoke with Agence France-Presse at the COP25 UN Climate Conference in Madrid, and answers have been edited for conclusion and clarity. So the question, is a viable solution to global warming compatible with consumer capitalism? And then he says, there's a simple way to answer that question. We don't have a choice. On climate, the time is running out so fast that there's no other pathway. Either we make this work within the existing economic paradigm or we fail. It's naive to say, let's go for degrowth or less growth, let's completely divest, or let's think of post-capitalist model and throw gross domestic product in the waste bin. We have to work with the economic machinery that we have in our engine room now. Then the other question is, why are fossil fuel companies reaching out to you and Earth system scientists for advice? European-based oil companies such as Shell, BP, former British Petroleum, and Equinor have not come to the point where they see the beginning of the end of their business. But I'm sure that they recognize that we have a serious problem. They are also very clever at engaging with the scientific community and allowing high ceiling when it comes to entertaining different perspectives. But they still translate everything into their own conclusions, which are mostly aligned with Shell's, quote, sky scenarios, end quote. Their argument goes like this. We serve humanity by supplying modern energy. Economies need cheap energy because otherwise they just grind to a halt. Don't blame us. We're just providing exactly what you're asking for. The sky scenario says that even with a 50% reduction in global greenhouse gas emissions over the next 30 years, Shell can be aligned with science and the Paris Agreement without changing very much. But this is an illusion that presumes the deployment of unrealistic levels of carbon capture and storage, CCS, a technology that siphons off carbon dioxide as gas or coal is burned and stores it underground, and tree planting. It is a feel-good strategy for the status quo. Today, we only have 300, 400, maybe 500 billion tons of carbon dioxide in our carbon budge left to emit, about 10 years worth. There is no more room for this type of posturing, and yet companies are still making major natural gas and oil investments in the Arctic and elsewhere. This won't take us to a net zero economy in time. So now the question is, could Earth flip from being a self-cooling to a self-warming system? He says, we should humbly cherish the fact that the Earth system remains in net cooling mode. We are loading the planet with heat by burning fuel, fossil fuels. So far, the Earth system has responded by dampening that heat. First, land and oceans absorb 50% of the emitted greenhouse gases. That's the biggest economic subsidy ever. Second, 90% of the excess heat we generate is taken up in the oceans. Third, ice sheets and the polar ice cap reflects 90% of solar radiation back into space. So we have carbon sequestration, heat absorption, and albedo, whereby the sun's energy is reflected back into space by mirror-like snow and ice as the three big cooling agents in Earth. And this is what has kept the system so resilient during the Holocene interglacial period over the last 12,000 years. I call the planet's capacity to buffer abuse Earth's resilience, end quote. So the big nightmare is the moment when Earth can no longer cope and shifts from that self-cooling state to become a net warmer. We don't know where that point is yet, but we see the mechanisms. The moment, for example, Greenland's ice sheet melts to such a large extent that it forms a film of liquid on the surface, we have already seen periods when it becomes a net absorber of heat rather than a net reflector of heat, not for more than a few weeks at a time, but it's starting to happen. We are also starting to see something similar with land-based ecosystems. We have had years when Earth's entire land surface is no longer a sink, but a net source of greenhouse gases. The point when the Earth system flips from being a net cooler to a net warmer is when you cross tipping points and you could end up in a state where that resilience is weakened so much that the climate system no longer reduces human disturbance, but rather reinforces it. And that will be the moment when we have lost control. Quote, we often hear that there are only 10 years left to the deal with climate change. And what does that mean? And he says, we have to start educating humanity that there are two timescales that matter when it comes to climate change. One is a deployment timescale, when we push the on button of irreversible change, whether for the melting of the ice sheets and the permafrost, or conversion of the Amazon from tropical forest to savanna. The other is the full impacts timeframe, which unfolds over centuries. We need to avoid the first one. We don't want to push the on buttons of runaway global warming. The next decade is our window to avoid coming too close to those pressure points. And that is the reality there. It needs to be considered. At least I think so. And this is very, very compelling. The death of the army chief, his name is Haid Salah, caps a turbulent year for Algeria. Algeria is powerful. Army chief General Ahmed Haid Salah died of a heart attack at the age of 79 today, threatening to deepen the country's political crisis at the end of a turbulent year. Haid Salah was seen as Algeria's de facto strongman following the April resignation of longtime President Abdelaziz Bouteflika in the face of massive protests against his bid for a fifth term. Now, the deputy defense minister and chief of staff of the army died Monday morning of a heart attack, the presidency said in a statement read out on state news channel Algeria 3. The general died at home of a heart attack at about 6 o'clock local time before his body was transferred to a military hospital, the statement had said. The lifelong military man had made his last public appearance on Thursday at the swearing of new President Abdelmahid Tebboune, who was seen as close to Haid Salah. Haid Salah was instrumental in pushing the December 12 vote that elected establishment insider Tebboune in defiance of a months-long protest movement demanding deep-rooted political reforms before any election. Well, at Thursday's ceremony, Haid Salah was also awarded the rank of Sadr, S-A-D-A-R, S-A-D-R, rather, in Algeria's National Order of Merit, an honor normally reserved for heads of state. As chief of the military for a record 15 years and a veteran of Algeria's War of Independence from France, the general was seen as the guardian of the military-dominated system that has been in power since. And when Bouteflika appointed him in 2004 to head the armed forces, the backbone of Algeria's opaque regime, he became one of the North American country's most powerful men. He loyally supported Bouteflika for years until the president's February announcement that he would run for re-election sparked unprecedented protest by the youth-led Hirak, H-I-R-A-K, movement in early April. Haid Salah called on his boss to resign. Bouteflika quit the same day, leaving the armed forces chief effectively in charge of the country. But the old soldier categorically rejected the Hirak movement's key demands, deep reforms, the establishment of transitional institutions, and the dismantling of the military-dominated regime. Musab Hamoudi of the School for Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences in Paris said weeks before Haid Salah's death that he was, quote, not a great strategist, end quote. He acts like a brutal soldier, he said. For him, Algeria is a huge barracks and making a concession is a weakness. His death comes as huge numbers of Algerians have continued protesting after Tebboune's appointment as president, rejecting his call to engage in dialogue. Haid Salah was born in 1940 in Batna region, some 300 kilometers or 190 miles southwest of Algiers, and spent more than six decades in the army or the armed forces. At the age of 17, he joined Algeria's National Liberation Army in its grueling eight-year war against French colonial forces. And when the country won independence in 1962, after 132 years as a French colony, he joined the army, attended a Soviet military academy, and rose through the ranks. Gaining a reputation for a hot temper, he commanded several regions before becoming chief of Algeria's land force at the height of a decade-long civil war pitting the regime against Islamist insurgents. In 2004, as he hit retirement age, he was picked by Bouteflika to replace overall chief of staff Mohamed Lamari, who had opposed the president's quest for a second mandate. Tebboune on Monday appointed Land Forces Commander General Saïd Chengria as interim military chief of staff, Algeria 3 reported, and he also declared 3 days of national mourning. So, a very, very compelling sort of set of circumstances, but there's so much more to talk about. Well, A Saudi court has sentenced 5 people to death, 3 to jail, over the Khashoggi killing. Well, it seems that Saudi Arabia on Monday sentenced 5 people to death and 3 more to jail over the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi last year and said the killing was not premeditated, a verdict criticized by a UN investigator as a, quote, mockery of justice, quote, unquote. Now, the court dismissed charges against the remaining 3 of the 11 people who had been on trial, finding them not guilty. Saudi deputy public prosecutor and spokesman Shalan Al-Shalan had said none of the defendants' names was immediately released. Now, the investigation showed that the killing was not premeditated. The decision was taken at the spur of the moment, Shalan had said, a position contradicting the findings of the United Nations-led investigation. Now, Khashoggi was a U.S. resident and critic of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the kingdom's de facto ruler. He was last seen at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October 2nd of 2018, where he had gone to obtain documents for his impending wedding. His body was reportedly dismembered and removed from the building, and his remains have not been found. 11 Saudi suspects were put on trial over his death in secretive proceedings in the capital of Saudi Arabia, Riyadh. Khashoggi's murder caused a global uproar, tarnishing the crown prince's image. The CIA and some Western governments have said they believe Prince Mohammed, also known as MBS, ordered the killing. Now, Saudi officials say he had no role, though in September, Prince Mohammed, for the first time, indicated some personal accountability for the murder, saying, quote, it happened under my watch, end quote. Agnes Callamar, the United Nations Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions, on Monday today lambasted the trial verdict as a, quote, mockery of justice, end quote. The hitmen are guilty, sentenced to death. The masterminds not only walk free, they have barely been touched by the investigation and the trial, she said on Twitter. The United Nations-led inquiry reported in February that the evidence pointed to a brutal and premeditated killing planned and perpetrated by Saudi officials. Last November, the Saudi prosecutor said that Saud al-Hattani, a former high-profile Saudi royal advisor, had discussed Khashoggi's activities before he entered the Saudi consulate with a team which went on to kill him. The prosecutor had said Hattani acted in coordination with Deputy Intelligence Chief Ahmed al-Asiri, who he said had ordered Khashoggi's repatriation from Turkey, and that the lead negotiator on the ground then decided to kill him. Now, both men were dismissed from their position, but while Asiri was tried, Hattani was not. On Monday, Shalan said Asiri had been tried and released due to insufficient evidence, and Hattani had been investigated but was not charged and had been released. Shalan also said the Saudi consul general to Turkey at the time, Mohammed al-Otaibi, had been freed after Turkish witnesses said Otaibi had been with them on the day of the crime. 2 weeks ago, the United States barred Otaibi from entering the country. Sources familiar with the matter told Reuters last year that Maher Moutreb, the lead negotiator, and Salah al-Tubaihi, a forensic expert specializing in autopsies, were also on trial for the murder and could face the death penalty. On Monday, Shalan said that when the Saudi team that entered the consulate saw that it would not be possible to transfer Khashoggi to a safe place to continue negotiation, they decided to kill him. It was agreed in consultation between the head of the negotiating team and the culprits to kill Jamal Khashoggi inside the consulate, Shalan said in response to questions from journalists. Well, Turkey said on Monday that the trial outcome was far from serving justice and repeated its call for better Saudi judicial cooperation. Quote, the fact that important issues like the location of the late Khashoggi's body, the identification of the investigators, and if there are any, the local cooperators are still in the dark is a fundamental shortcoming to justice being served with accountability, so said the foreign ministry spokesman Hani Aksoy had said. Palomar, the United Nations rapporteur, criticized the trial for having been held behind closed doors, saying that the conditions in international law for doing so had not been met. Human rights group Amnesty International also criticized the closed trial, branding the verdict as a whitewash, quote unquote. The verdict falls, or rather fails, to address the Saudi authorities' involvement in the devastating crime or clarify the location of Jamal Khashoggi's remains, Amnesty said in a statement. In the murder investigation, 21 people were arrested and 10 called in for questioning without arrest, according to Shalan. Now, Riyadh's criminal court pronounced a death penalty on 5 defendants, quote, for committing and directly participating in the murder of the victim, end quote. The 3 sentenced to prison were given various sentences totaling 24 years for their role in covering up this crime and violating the law, end quote. Shalan added the investigations proved there was no, quote, prior enmity, end quote, between those convicted and Khashoggi. The verdicts can still be appealed. So we'll have to see where all that goes. Well, now let me just quickly look at some other things that are very, very compelling. India's Modi tells the country's Muslims not to worry as deadly protests continue. Well, Prime Minister Narendra Modi sought on Sunday to reassure India's Muslims over a new citizenship law that had sparked deadly protests and put his Hindu nationalist government under pressure like never before. The unrest is set to continue with a silent protest planned in the country's capital on Monday. That's today. It may be happening already now, but it's too soon for us to be able to tell. At least 25 people have died in almost 2 weeks of demonstrations and violence after Modi's government passed the law criticized as anti-Muslim. More protests took place on Sunday in the Hindu-majority nation, addressing party supporters in New Delhi who cried, Modi, Modi, at the mention of the law. The prime minister said Muslims, quote, don't need to worry at all, end quote, provided they are genuine Indians. Quote, Muslims who are sons of the soil and whose ancestors are the children of Mother India need not to worry, Modi, who is 69, told the crowd of thousands. Accusing the main opposition Congress party of condoning the violence by not condemning it, Modi said opponents were, quote, spreading rumors that all Muslims will be sent to detention camps, end quote. There are no detention centers, he said. All these stories about detention centers are lies, lies, and lies, he said. Despite the prime minister's assertion, the northeastern state of Assam has 6 detention centers holding more than 1,000 alleged illegal immigrants, or rather alleged migrants, and plans another 11. India's junior home minister has told parliament that 28 detainees have died in the camp in recent years. The home ministry in June issued a, quote, 2019 model detention manual, end quote, to states, asking them to set up camps in major entry points. Two centers were planned near the cities of Mumbai and Bangalore. Modi also said that there had been, quote, no discussion, end quote, about a nationwide, quote, register of citizens, end quote, which many Muslims in India fear is targeted mainly at them. Home Minister Amit Shah, Modi's right-hand man, has said repeatedly that such an exercise will take place aimed at removing all, quote, infiltrators from India, end quote. Well, the ruling party also promised in their 2019 national election manifesto to implement NRC in a phased manner in order in other parts of the country. So this year, such a register in Assam state left only 1.9 million people unable to prove they or their forebears were there before 1971. They now face possible statelessness. Demonstrations against the citizenship law has been largely peaceful, but protesters have also hurled rocks and torched or vehicles or lit them afire, while heavy-handed police tactics, including the storming of a Delhi university a week ago, have fueled anger. Tens of thousands of protesters gathered late Saturday in the southern city of Hyderabad. Other large demonstrations took place on Sunday, including in Jaipur and Mumbai. In Bangalore, other protesters gathered to support the law. It gives religious minority members, Hindus, Sikhs, Jains, Parsis, Christians, and Buddhists, from three neighboring Islamic countries an easier path to citizenship, but not if they are Muslim. Well, Islamic groups, the opposition, and others at home and abroad fear this forms part of Modi's aim to marginalize India's 200 million Muslims and remold the country as a Hindu nation. Authorities have imposed emergency laws and blocked internet access across the country in an attempt to contain the unrest. More than 7,500 people have either been detained under emergency laws or arrested for rioting, according to state officials, and 5,000 of them are being held in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh state, where 17 people have been killed. The state's government has said it will confiscate and auction properties of those involved in arson and destruction of public properties to recover damages. Police said they sealed 70 shops owned by accused rioters in the state of Muzaffarnagar district, where two protesters were killed on Friday. About 500 people, more than half of them police, have also been injured in Uttar Pradesh. And two people were shot dead in the southern state of Karnataka, and six died in Assam in the northeast last week. In Assam, opponents of the citizenship legislation fear it will enable large numbers of Bengali-speaking Hindu immigrants to settle there. But elsewhere, opponents say the law has made religion a test of citizenship ahead of a nationwide register that Modi wants to carry out by 2024 to remove all, quote, infiltrators, end quote. Modi's government, reelected in May, has defended the law, saying it is meant to help, quote, persecuted, end quote, minorities from Muslim-majority Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan. Oh, my goodness. So we'll see where all that leads. It's going to be very, very interesting, to say the least. This is very unsettling. A U.S. soldier is killed in Afghanistan in Afghanistani attacks. The Taliban claim responsibility. The Taliban today claimed responsibility for an attack on an American convoy that killed one U.S. soldier and, according to the insurgents, wounded several more. The killing is likely to have consequence for ongoing talks between the United States and the Taliban. President Donald Trump in September declared negotiations dead, quote unquote, after the Taliban killed a U.S. soldier in a Kabul bombing. Negotiations have since restarted in Doha, but were earlier this month put on a pause following, quote, yet another bombing, this time at the Bagram Air Base north of Kabul. According to U.S. forces, Afghanistan, one American service member died in combat on Monday following an attack. The Americans did not release any additional information. In a WhatsApp message to Agence France Press, Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid said insurgents blew up an American vehicle in Shah Dara district of Kunduz late on Sunday night. Depending on how one qualifies a combat-related death, at least 20 American soldiers have been killed in action in Afghanistan this year following Monday's announcement. That makes 2019 the deadliest for U.S. forces since combat operations officially finished at the end of 2014 and highlights the challenging security situation that persists across much of Afghanistan. More than 2,400 U.S. troops have been killed in combat in Afghanistan since the U.S.-led invasion in October of 2001. The attack comes one day after officials announced preliminary results in Afghanistan's presidential elections that put President Ashraf Ghani on track to secure a second term. The Taliban have long viewed Ghani as an American stooge. So we'll see where all that goes. Now, let's quickly go back. Oh, yeah, one last thing. Boeing's CEO was ousted after the 737 MAX crisis. Boeing company has fired Chief Executive Officer Dennis Muilenburg following a year of intense scrutiny and industrial setbacks set off by twin fatal crashes of its 737 MAX jetliner. The management shakeup comes as the world's largest plane maker struggles to win regulatory approvals for its grounded, best-selling jetliner while trying to regain trust with passengers and airline customers. Chairman David Calhoun will take over as CEO and president effective January 13, the company said, adding that a change in leadership was necessary to restore confidence in the company. The company shares rose nearly 4% in early trading. 737 MAX grounding was the biggest crisis of Muhlenberg's 34-year tenure at Boeing, where he started as an intern in 1985, rising through the company's defense and services ranks to the top job in 2015. The company said this month it would stop production of the jets in January. A senior industry source called the wording of Boeing's statement brutal, quote unquote. Another said the decision was inevitable after spiraling pressures from the 737 production halt to a public slapdown from the Federal Aviation Authority, tapped off by an embarrassing space launch snafu on Friday. Speculation that Muhlenberg would be fired had been circulating in the industry for months, intensifying in October when the board stripped him of his chairman title. A Boeing official said the board deliberated over the weekend and they made the decision to fire Muhlenberg in a phone call on Sunday. Aerospace analyst Richard Abulafia said that the appointment of Calhoun, who previously served as head of Blackstone Group's private equity portfolio operation, will provide needed short-term stability, but not the long-term emphasis on engineering the company needs. Calhoun is respected in the industry, Abulafia said on Monday, but long-term, does he bring the right toolkit? Equity or private equity leans companies out, companies out. That's not Boeing's problem right now. And a board member, Lawrence Kellner, will become non-executive chairman of the board effective immediately. The company said Chief Financial Officer Greg Smith will serve as interim CEO during the brief transition period. And, quote, under the company's new leadership, Boeing will operate with a renewed commitment to full transparency, including effective and proactive communication with the Federal Aviation Authority, the FAA, other global regulators, and its customers, Boeing said. And keeping Muhlenberg in the job as long as Boeing has the company was ignoring elements of the classic crisis communication playbook used by other companies, said Paul Argenti, a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. Quote, you want to bring somebody from the outside to bring fresh perspective to, quote, save the day, end quote, Argenti said. He should have been gone a long time ago. He is part of the problem. Unbelievable. Okay, so no, that's the end of that. It took too long, if you must know. Well, that's my perspective. I think it really has taken too long to get this guy out, and it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt Boeing. It's going to hurt very badly. So bear with me a moment here, and go back to our studio screen. Let's find out what's going on in our neck of the woods. And one second, and let's play for you what's going on at the Cabot Creamery.
Hey, you a judge?
Well, sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. Evidently, a news report out of Yonkers. Yonkers has been awarded a $350,000 for a new boat dock at the downtown city pier. Funding was awarded by New York State Regional Economic Development Council, which will support growing demand for excursions, dinner cruises, and commuter ferry service. They messed that up years ago, and now we're back at this commuter ferry service. The city of Yonkers will receive $350,000 for the construction of a new floating boat dock along the Yonkers downtown waterfront through New York State's latest round of Regional Economic Development Council, REDC, awards. Mayor Mike Spano announced today, quote, "This is an exciting project that will meet the increasing demand for waterborne tourism and transportation by expanding boat access to Yonkers' growing downtown waterfront area," said the mayor. "It's another example of how we are utilizing our location and natural assets to establish waterfront amenities that attract new residents and visitors, foster transit-oriented development, and solidify Yonkers as a regional destination." The new floating, that's your quote, "The new floating dock will be constructed on the north side of the 1901 two-story city pier located in the downtown waterfront district and will supplement boat access at the existing dock on the pier's south side, which has emerged as a popular maritime destination for excursion and educational vessels and Hudson River cruise ships. The dock will foster the introduction of dinner cruise operators and is anticipated to become one of the home ports for the Henry Hudson's replica ship, the Half Moon, upon its return to the Hudson Valley from the Netherlands. And the dock is also envisioned to support future commuter ferry service between Yonkers and Manhattan. I thank Governor Cuomo and the REDC for their continued support through this competitive grant program, which has yielded millions of dollars in investment in economic development projects throughout Yonkers," said Mayor Spano. "The REDC funding awarded to Yonkers will leverage $1.1 million in city capital funds already approved for the project." Okay, so that's the story there. And let me just quickly look. I think that's where we are. And at the moment, let me just quickly see what's happening for tomorrow. Well, today, of course, is there are Hanukkah celebrations that are taking place around the city. Tomorrow is Christmas Eve. We will be on with on radio on the 24th during Christmas Christmas Eve, but it will be on in the morning, actually. And then we will have a program as well on Christmas Day to cover the news. And so that's our story. And then for Kwanzaa on Thursday, we'll be operating as well. So that's the story. That's where we are today. I hope you'll consider joining us tomorrow. Just the news, you and I, nothing more. No guests planned at the moment. And we'll see where that goes. So have a great day. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you to John Bailey from the White Plains Citizenet Reporter. He's the publisher and editor. And then, of course, Michael Edelman, the national political pundit or analyst that we speak to with great delight. And between the two of them, starting off the day, it's really fantastic. It just doesn't get better than that as far as I'm concerned. Very, very compelling. And I guess that's where we're at. All right, so we'll wish you a good day, and thank you again for joining us. Be well. Goodbye.